track, session number 14982, Mr. Jay Brown, reel 4.
Mr. Brown, reel 4.
Well,
we were talking about the training, Mr. Brown.
About the training. Well, probably at least once a week you'd have a company's game, you know. Maybe once a fortnight there'd be one arranged with the battalion, you know, where you went out in the areas and it was up to the officers there and keeping control. There's a company there. You didn't know they were there, but you know, and something was happening which you didn't know nothing about. And you got into a position to fight, of course there was nobody to fight like. But you went through the motions. Then in between time, you did it as individual platoons. Like, as a light machine gun platoon, we used to march out to Childbury Village, away to a place called Henstock, and we used to turn left and go up about a mile, reading up on the top. It was real wild countryside. There was one farm over there, there was nothing else. And we used to do a train up there, section stocks and such as that. And we used to put some, you know, we were keen like, to be fair. And we still had Tommy Carr, the bugle major, whereas he'd got the rank of platoon sergeant major then. They couldn't get enough officers at that time, so seeing the NCOs, or warrant officers, was they were given the rank of platoon sergeant major that took the place of the officer. I was still a corporal then, like, and that's all I could afford in the platoon. But we used to do these section stocks and bits of training, and you used to practice bayonet fighting and all that. No, well, you know, Tommy used to give it like, and the usual training. And anyway, while we were up there, there was a lot of wildlife up there, rabbits and this, that, and the other. But two or three lads with us had been in the bugle, and they were boys, you know. When I went to France, they didn't go. They were just underage, you see. They stopped and they went to the boys' battalion at Bransworth Camp, somewhere like that. Never saw them again. Later on, one of them men went to other battalions. So one, I think he's dead now, he had a bad end. But Lenny Fox, he's just a kid. And he made a bit of his trade in peacetime. I think he knew all about rabbits and what have you. He used to set the snares when we were up there, you know. Dusting at night. He used to send Lenny up there. He had a nose for it like a ferret, you know. Come back with a couple of rabbits, you know. Well, I had understanding with the kooks, you know. We're getting, as I said, we got you good, but not too much. It's the middle of the night, you know. We're having rabbit pie, you know, out for town in the coach. The officer used to go, never any questions, I think he'd have his part, you know, just know which other officer was, must have passed the word round. Get down to coach, I was saying, that machine gun for town, dining out again. Hey, things like that, man. You have to look after yourself.
Did you lose any men who were taken back into civilian life because they were key men?
Miners, we did. Aye, that's the point I was going to get to. In fact, the war was only a fortnight old when I said any ex-miners, anybody over 30 years of old age, an ex-miner, and go back to the pits. Well, we lost throughout the battalion. Must have lost somewhere about 50 odd, you know. There was a lot of miners who said, oh, I'm not bloody gone, I'm stopping with the battalion, you know. But quite a lot, mostly married men or kids, they went back to the pits. We didn't discriminate them, it was their own being. But when we got to this Childbury, there was a thing started pre-war, about 1800, what they called the militia, the first militia. They were calling lads up, 18-year-old, and they were really, you know, they were smarting them up, you know, intensive training for 12 months. For anywhere the war started, we got a draft from the King's Own Scottish Borders. They weren't all Scotsmen, like the Borders, like both sides, but they come out of Childbury, there was hell on for the first fortnight. Nowhere were they going to be with the damn right if they wanted to be back with the King's Own Scottish Borders now. And that big, beautiful cat badge of theirs compared to the damn right. No, they weren't having that. And anyway, the Jonty Curry, the Bulger among them, he started them out. Anyway, within 3 months, there were stauncher Durhams than we were. There was quite a lot went on. A lot went on for promotion, decoration. There was two got a commission. One got commissioned. Two got commissioned in the field. Aye. And
did Did any of these join your own particular platoon? Did any of these join your own particular platoon?
Oh, yes, platoon? We lost some. We got Frankie Trotter from Dumfries and a rugby player, Christ almighty, Dougie Hinton from Hoyke, and Darcy Anderson from Hoyke. He was a good player, that Darcy Anderson. I don't know if they're alive or dead. I used to write them one time, and then all of a sudden they dried up. So, in fact, this Dougie Hinton, he came down when the wife was alive. I was talking just a few years after war. They'll come down twice or three times for the holidays and stayed with us. I was living in Durham at the time. And nice little wife, his wife Nellie, quietly, proper little Scots lass, you know. We went up there once. And I used to write and send a card every year. And about 5 years ago, I never got a reply. And so I didn't write. I thought, well, Dougie must have died. And it's making hard work writing the same way, is everybody all right? If I ever got round, I would go up and quietly and ask, you know, make inquiries like that. Not that it matters.
How well equipped were you as a battalion at the beginning of the war? Were your weapons all up to, you know, numbers and everything?
Why, I suppose so, aye, but not compared to the German army. We weren't in the hunt, you know. You say, first of all, the concentrator, they formed an anti-tank platoon. Well, they spent a fortune on little 2-pound anti-tank ones, you know what I mean? Peace shooters. They would knock a tank off from here, maybe just across the road, like. But I mean, you had the position where the German tanks had 800,000 yards, they could knock your tanks out. Or they can knock the anti-tank guns out, you know. The only thing you could use our anti-tanks is find a hidey hole and hope to God he come where near. You know, I've seen that happen, like, and blow his tracks off. But that sort of thing. It was a handy little gun, understand, but a real short-range weapon, you know. And that was a disadvantage right up to 1942, just before the Battle of Alamein, when we got the 6-pounder. Now, we started to get American tanks, you know. We got the Grants first, and then they got the better version, the Sherman 360 degree tank. I mean, we weren't tank men, but we knew what it was all about, like, and that and the other. But going back to Childbury, we seem to be overcrowded down there, but there was a good feeling among everybody, you know. There's never very little this, except when these Scots lads settled in, and they were great, you know, after that, like. And as I say, late in the war, there were staunch Durhams in the world, British Scotsmen. There's Northumberland lads among them and all, you know.
Did you become, we talked about being mobile, were you getting the carrier?
Well, we had a carrier platoon, aye, English and charge, I think.
You weren't transported by carriers?
No, I wasn't with carriers, no. But I knew pretty much about them, like what they were doing and all that, you know, but they were good to get ahead of the battalion, you know, and scouting and this, that, and the other, quickly into a covering position to help you out and such as that, you know. And they were harassment-wise, they were against the enemy, like, that they did a good job of work, the carriers. Good. I mean, they wouldn't stop the anti-tank shelling out like that, you know. But machine gun fire would rattle off them.
Looking back prior to going to France and meeting the Germans, did you feel that your training really prepared you for that time when you met the Germans?
Why, it's a very difficult question to answer because we were trained and we were confident, you say. But they'll start to give you one of our last moves into northern France before the Boulogne went up. Digging anti-tank ditches, you know. And then that was, we started to dig again. The digging infantry positions with a firing step on and all that. Well, somewhere down the line, somebody must have known that was a waste of time, like, you know. But they must have known the German had literally hundreds, if not thousands, of tanks. And that he wasn't going to be sitting all on the ground firing tanks. He was going to be trying to run your own. And that sort of thing.
You didn't do any training with other units of the forces, tanks or... At this stage, you didn't do any or Air Force?
Not at that stage. Not when we went to France, like, there was, we're moving here, one village there, some places, pretty awful billets, and others were just as nice. some of the French people were saying to be down the dumps. The others were kindly and wanted to be friends and talk to you. And then there was one big training area we went to, Oisey or some place like that, was a JHQ training area. And for about a month, we really went through it there. They did everything, you know. Divisional training, battalion training, company training, captain, that, and this, that, and the other. But it was very good training, that. But it was mobile training. At a certain position, you had to get there in the trucks, get offload and get in, you know. Then get out the best of your corridor. Trucks would come up and you'd move a bit farther forward. It was just how the high command decided you should do it, you know. But they were fit and strong and they were keen, like. And then the Germans come up with blitzkrieg warfare with nobody knew about it. I started to get the boat out and start to learn.
Did you get leave whilst you were down in Chowbury?
Yes, we got an embarkation leave. Aye, we got one leave. Some were lucky, they hit on Christmas, very few. But it was so, the situation was so intense at time, time limit wise, I suppose, like, that they just couldn't give the leave when they felt like it. We had to go to, the whole battalion went to, went by road, went by own wagons, closed in on Castle Brummage. There's a bloody big building there. I don't know what that was supposed to be, the castle. It was a real old, dirty old place. We were stuck in there. And he used to take us down on a morning about, 8 or 10 miles down. Kingsbury Range, they called it. And it was winter, of course. It was frosty and cold, but we were enjoying it. Used to fire our courses there, you know, really, really putting you through it, like. And it was good, that, like. We enjoyed that. And then I started with these gas masks, so, do you mean? To finish that, find your course off that, you had to do it with gas masks, you know. Where later on, I got these little domes. You had a bit of cloth, and you rubbed some on the lens, you know, and that stopped them steaming up. But before that, they steamed up, you know. And Johnny the Bull was shouting now, and on the fire front, right, I'll get your gas masks on, you know, he's shouting. And you know your targets, aim at your target, it's only about 300 yards. Right, 5 rounds, rapid. I couldn't see a thing in that, do you mean? The missing up, Johnny shouting, take your gas masks off, fix bayonets. He was only joking. And they fixed bayonets, he said, we'll charge. He said, you put more bloody holes in the target. Until it got round to them like that, to do something about the gas. The gas masks were a waste of time. I mean, if there'd been a gas attack, okay. But, hey, I don't know.
Did you have to go through the gas hut? Part of your training.
You did your gas training and that a steel fabricated hut. Maybe as big as this room, give or take, you know. And that these gas, do they call them bombs or discs or whatever in there? You had to get in there, see, and say, right now, you had to hold your breath. The first thing you do when this is a gas attack, they say, what's the first thing you do? Put your gas mask on. No, you need to hold your breath. You know, get it on. The left, you know, was it 2 or 3 minutes? And you're trying not to breathe while you're in, you know. Some of my eyes are sticking out here. I was breathing, I thought, wait, because I've tried to gas myself, keep them tight here to make sure. And then out you come, and that was it, like. I didn't know anybody had a leaky gas mask, and I didn't know anybody that was really in any trouble, not even in our particular section anyway. But they did that sort of thing. And then you got endless lectures on the people that taken the lecture didn't know. They were having to read it off a pamphlet, you know, about the different types of gas and how what happened and one thing and another. Now, we did a big scheme one time. We went up onto Exmoor, of course, scheme, you know, depth of winter. We just got up, it was about that much snow. Someone was cut off for weeks, like. But in the meantime, did a bit manoeuvring around. You had your gas capes and had a Lysander coming over. And he was dropping some kind of liquid. They said it was aniseed, but whether it was aniseed or not, didn't know. But you used to put a stick with a disc on the top, you know, and the disc changed colour. That was liquid gas, you know. Why, this aniseed or whatever was supposed to be, have the same reaction as a liquid gas. And I think it was a waste of time with that trouble. But snowing like hell, it dropped for their drop with my dog.
No. You would get your embarkation leave. When was that?
Oh, Christ. Mine was before Christmas, I think. So they were staggering, you know, before Christmas time.
Did you know it was an embarkation leave you were getting? Had they told you it was an embarkation leave?
Yes, it was an embarkation
How leave. Was the news received at home that you were...
Why, I mean, the country was at war, you see, and there were everybody wishing you the best, you know. And I wasn't married then, but I was engaged to be married, and I said to the wife, the future wife, said, the first leave I get will get married. I said, I didn't know when that would be. I had no idea, you know. But it was after Dunkirk, right? So we got married then. And then carrying on from there, we've got to go into that story yet, but the next time I got another leave after that, then an embarkation leave the next April. I never saw it for 4 years until months.
Knowing now that you were going abroad and probably to meet the Germans, had your attitudes changed? Or were you concerned, or were you still the brave young man?
Well, I don't think brave's a word. You just didn't care. I mean, you didn't have any... You didn't know what the Germans had. You didn't know that that superior equipment at the time and so many men that highly trained like and such as that. But... The Germans are overrated, you know. Good soldiers, what's the tact of a good soldier? I mean, they had all them years start. That's the way I look at it, mind. But our brigade proved in northern France, like, when we... Well, I wouldn't come to that, yeah. We did a bit of a counter-attack, and it was supposed to close the gap, but the French let us down badly and all that. But our brigade did quite well, and the armoured unit that was supporting us, and we had a brigade out, the 5th Division, did well. They took hundreds of German prisoners, you know, I didn't know what hit them. They weren't used for somebody attacking them. The dive bombers and the tanks were doing all the fighting for them. They were singing and shouting, coming through the wood, half drunk with French wine, all the proper brave guys. They didn't like it all, and the boys got among them.
Yeah, we'll come to that. At the end of your leave, you'd come, obviously, back to camp. How long was it before you actually did set off for France?
About the end of January, wasn't it? Could have been, was it? Must have been the end of January. I mean,
Were you being censored now? Was your mail being censored?
No, at the end of January, the advance party left. Eh? And then early February, we went to France. You mean
Your mail, was it being censored at this stage?
Not to my knowledge, but was when we got to France. Once you got to France, you know, you had to write somewhere in France, like, I mean, I think the Germans would be interested in that.
Did the people of Charlesbury have any idea that you were leaving? Was there kind of a message?
Well, then you would come a time when we would leave, like, but what happened, while we were at Charlesbury, they were improving where they could, you know. We had this Major McLaren, he's quite a good officer, like, your second commander. He was down with acting battalion commander, you understand, acting lieutenant colonel. Well, we got a Lieutenant Colonel Beat. He'd been major and promoted from the 2nd Battalion. He's unmarried, you know, typical old army type. Another gentleman, mind, thin, fit as fire, all that. But a real good soldier and a gentleman. He came and took command of the battalion. And he got wounded in France. And McLaren took over and got the DSO. Then Tim Beat, they called, and Beat came back to us later on after he came out of hospital. He went to the Middle East with us. And he stayed with us right into the desert. And when we were in the desert, he got promoted to brigadier and took over an Indian brigade. We lost him then.
So had you had many officer changes in these very early days of the war? Or was it still basically
just behind? As I said, the colonel was Leyburn. He had to retire through it. And McLaren was doing the job in the meantime, this Major McLaren, you see. I'm trying to remember his second in command. Oh, God. But his second in command, he took command of the 11th Battalion. He got the 11th Battalion to command, like. His name might come to us. But that sort of thing, you know, I mean, that reorganisation would be going on up and down every regiment, I suppose, in the country, like.
You remember the actual day that you moved out of Charlesbury for France? We'd be in the middle of winter.
Oh, it was the middle of winter. Oh, dear me, it was terrible. I might have the day. I mean, you didn't register the dates in your mind, but end of January, I went to train to Charlesbury. I went to Southampton by train. But it was a bitter day when we left Charlesbury. That some of the companies had to march into Charlesbury, you know. It was probably the coldest I'd ever been in England. I mean, up here, we're pretty tough. They didn't get it down there, but I couldn't understand what happened. But I don't know how the dates. It must have been maybe the first week in February or something like that, like, you know. But before that, we had to march to Chipping Norton. That's where the 6th Battalion was. The King was taken. Talk about a cold beer, you never say no like it. Right. What I should have said before, the buglers were trained as machine gunners, the bandsmen, they were trained as stretcher bearers and medical men, you see. But at that moment of time, they still had the gear. Went, set off to march to this Chipping Norton, I don't know how many miles, it's Connie Trek. No great coach, you know. Anyway, the wagon come brought the great coach before the King got there, which is just as well. They were standing there bloody shivering. Everybody had big rosy red faces, you know. The King looked as sick as a parrot. And anyway, it come down to march up. If you'd heard that band, they were frozen up, you know. There's nothing, you know, just squeaks coming out. He must have understood, like.
What was your impression of the King?
Why, I didn't know. He's, I was sorry for him. He didn't look very well to me. You know, I wouldn't have swapped him, like. I was young and strong, like. I didn't look at him that way. He's just king-like, and you were taught to respect him, you know. But he, I don't think there was any worship out like that. We saw him later again. The two early 30s, and after we'd come back from the little turn, like, but that was interesting when we saw him again. He was just the same fella of mine, but seemed a nice, quiet. He was doing a job, looked sick, like. He had to do it, you know, little fella.
So you moved up to Southampton?
And we spent a day there, was it? Or was two or three days, I think. And then they decided to go to France. We got on his troop, I can't even remember the name of his troop ship. We got on late at night, and he pulled out somewhere at sea, out in the Solent or somewhere, he dropped anchor. I said, oh, he's changed his mind, we're going back with one detail. Then it started to move when it was dark, you know. So it was out of a rough crossing dike, you know, I couldn't say, you know, you could down that, some of them sick. And then dawn broke, pulled into Cherbourg Harbour. What a miserable bloody place, Cherbourg. It was raining, this, that, and the other. And it was sheer austerity. There's a big building there. It was all concrete steps going up the big halls. Nothing in. There's not a picture. There's no sheer concrete, you know, like giant dungeons. That's the French poor at the time. Anyway, there was blokes there. You get organising companies. And there were that big, what do you call them, full of McConaughey's steel, you know. You went with your mess team, got a tin full of steel, like, and put away tea and all that.
Any Frenchmen about?
Huh?
Any Frenchmen about?
Oh, the Frenchmen. I don't know whether it was a French home guard or what, but oh dear me. Discrepant blokes standing supposed to be on guard with them funny bloody helmets on, cigarette down there, never been washed this year, and the rifle along in there, standing half asleep. One along here, well, I'm going to take a French loaf out, and he's cutting bits of dry bread off and gone like that. You know, but that wasn't the French army, really. That was, whether the army or not, or the criminal or a warm guard was 25,000 times better than them fellas. But later on, as you moved in, you got cracking to some of them, like, and the cafes and that, you know, when you had a bit of time, they seemed to think we were so young, in a critical way, you know. We were young and rosy cheeked, like. We weren't, we were bloody hard as nails, most of them, ex-miners, and this, that and the other, real tough, hard bloke, but a lot of them in a kind of way, so young boys, you know, while some of that bloody old men didn't put up much of a show, like, when the chip was down. Never mind.
So you landed at Cherbourg, then what happened?
We landed at Cherbourg, and we spent the day around, it was raining, it rained all day, you know, drizzling and that, it wasn't very warm. So not go too far away, you had to come back, and then there's a railway station there, climbed on again. And then French trains have square wheels, if anybody doesn't know. Like, off we went, we're going, it was turning dark like that, it was dark then. We're going through villages and what you want, what's interesting, getting a look. And I remember going through Cannes, you know. I saw a sign of Cannes, that was the only favourite place I knew, it was Cannes. And where the hell did we finish up? We sent Remy's up playing. Was it? Oh, that was only a stopping point leg. But the weather turned so bad rain, we were there, we were there for about a fortnight, were we? And it was, what a miserable, dirty place, you know. The people, must have been the place, the people didn't, wasn't very friendly, didn't want to talk. Anyway,
Where were you billeted?
We built in anywhere, again, by the hotel, built any stables out, you know, broken down houses, we shook anything that had a roof on. And a lot of the roads was leaking, and all, you know, the service. And then we moved to another village. But it was nice, we spent a week there, what the hell to call it. It was clean, it was pretty, and the people were trying to be friendly. Yeah, I kept writing these bits of things down just to jog the mind, you know. Where the hell was it?
Were you involved in any training at this early stage, or just hanging
I forget the name of this village, but that was a nice little place, like, and we're only there working. Now we moved again to a place, Oisey or something. It wasn't far from Amiens, about 10 or 12 miles, I was thinking something like that. But it was training again, like, you're really getting into your training then, you know. They were pushing it then, like. And we've got some more shit, though, like. Now we had a following row. I mean, there wasn't much to talk about then, like, if there was a localist down here, someone, you got in, there's no beer than out in France, the little cafes or the staminas or whatever, the plain top tables, you know. But all they had was that white wine, would rot your guts, Vin Blanc and Vin Rouge, was just as bad, like. Mixing them both was terrible. And you did that sort of thing. And it's mostly a place with too small life at have anywhere for entertainment. Now we moved again to up Gondicourt. We were stopped there till the balloon went up. It was about a few miles from Lille. And Lille's a big city, like, quite big. The cairns, you got to lift up under Lille, you know, because the lads were looking around sightseeing, some were looking for brothels and this, that, the other sort of thing went on.
And what were you doing at Gondicourt? You were there quite a while.
Well, training, you know, you a lot of platoon training and such as that. And then we start to do a lot of digging. You know what I mean? We're digging anti-tank dishes for what? To stop what? Nobody seemed to know, you know. But you didn't sort of pinpoint your mind. Without talking about it, you thought this is going to be a hell of a long war, like. But you didn't know tomorrow hell what was going, when it was going to, you know.
And how large were these tank ditches you were drawing?
These what?
How big was the tank ditches?
Well, they were just a sheer face, like some of them. Well, I don't know what kind of tank was stuck there. I mean, you graded it down, not to be a wall facing you behind, you know. Why, anybody with any common sense, like, they thought, well, there's ways and means of getting over that work with modern tanks. They seem to think, I don't know. There was lectured us one time about tanks that if, you know, this concertina wire. If you put a concertina wire fence up, a tank runs through it, his tracks will seize up. And I was saying, funny that. Way in
there. Was the ditch part of a defensive system? Were there other things, trenches and pillboxes on the line?
It must have been, you know. I mean, of course, they didn't discuss it with us. And to be honest, you weren't really. You knew, well, there's some kind of defence, but you didn't. Your mind didn't dwell out and say, well, I wonder how far this goes, and I wonder what's half a mile away there. You certainly, you were interested in the war, but you weren't interested in that, like. You were just interested in tomorrow. I wonder what tomorrow brings, like. You know, that sort of thing. And but you, those little cafes and one thing and another, such as they were, you could have a drink and one thing and another. And they organised games when they could in between times, football and such as that, you know.
Did your digging start early in the morning, and were you digging all day?
Why, they weren't digging all day. No, they were as far as out, because they staggered it two or three times, you know, digging on a morning, digging on a summer day on an afternoon or something like that. And then, if I remember correctly, not ours, like, I think the rifle companies had a competition who could do the best trench, you know. And I don't know what the price was, what the end product was, but there used to be talk about that. You used to say, hey, the air company's built a good enough big company, you know, right to be over there somewhere, you sort of didn't go and say, like.